things can and they will change. Thank you very much.
I'm here today at the People's History Museum in Manchester, and it's a wonderful day. We've just come from the commemoration of the Peterloo Massacre of 1819. And I'm here today on behalf of the Peace and Justice Project to explore some issues around history in Manchester, trade union strength and working class unity, but also about the role of theatre and art and music and how that impacts on all of our cultures and all of our lives, but particularly impacts on the strength of working class communities going through incredible hardship, as is happening at the moment. So it's an absolute pleasure and honour to be able to talk this afternoon to Maxine Peake.
It's an absolute pleasure.
You are quintessentially Manchester, if I may say so, or am I overstepping the mark here?
Well, I'm actually born in Bolton and live in Salford.
So the first faux pas by me is that I've got
but everyone says I'm a Mancunian, and actually, technically, I'm
you're Salford, okay. Right, so
I'll let you take us
back to Salford.
Yeah.
Salford, great history, great MPs, Frank Alorne, Rebecca Long Bailey now, and then Walter Greenwood, Love on the Dole.
Yeah. Well, Salford, to be honest, I think Manchester sometimes sort of hijacks a lot of Salford's history.
Well, it was imperial control.
Exactly. But I think even through our sort of, modern contemporary culture, there's a lot of things that you go, actually, do you realise that's Salford? But there's always been, because the cities are so close to each other, you can have one foot in Salford and one foot in Manchester, people sort of... And Salford's always been Manchester's sort of poorer relation.
Yeah.
Or it's been perceived as that, which I'm very adamant and upset about when people say, you're from Manchester? I say, no, I'm from Salford. Or they say Salford, Manchester, and I say Salford, Salford. Anyway, but yes, Salford has a fantastic... a progressive history. Obviously, as we know, Marx and Engels spent a lot of time in Salford, and we have, let's say, Walter Greenwood, the playwright, Love on the Dole. We have the high-rise flats. We've got the Walter Greenwood flats that are named after him. Let's say Frank Alorne, the amazing Rebecca Long Bailey. Salford, I must admit, Salford Council do some very good work within the community. And is there popular culture like musicians, Jimmy Miller, who then became Ewan McCall, changed his name, Salford lad, obviously a big influence. John Littlewood came here and then, inspired her with the theatre workshop and everything that went forward. But I think currently as well, there's a lot goes on. We've got the Working Class Movement Library.
And you, of course, had Sylvia Pankhurst.
Yeah, there is a plethora of inspirational people who've come through Salford, and I think it was dock, quite a famous dock, city, and obviously there's a lot of hardship and in many cities and poverty, and which then gives rise to movements, and so I'm very proud to be a resident of Salford.
And how does that history of inspirational writers, leaders, and struggle affect the day-to-day struggles that people have over rent, over housing, over jobs and wages and so on? Because Salford was a huge industrial centre.
Yeah.
It's not anything like that proportion now, but there's a lot of traditions there. Remember the days of Metro Vic, biggest factory in Britain, if not Europe, massive place.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me it's always... So trying to make people aware of Salford's history, of the history of the struggle, of the history of progress and progress and the progressives that came from Salford, because we are, like you say, where we are now in society, where politically we are, and there's a hell of a lot of poverty in Salford, as we know, in the north in general, and it progressively gets worse because you move further north. We know cities, especially like Salford, Manchester, we look at Manchester now, it's a big, it's a huge pulsing, corporate, the buildings are going up at the rate of knots. It's become the very zhuzhy place to live. I mean, some of that is knocking into Salford, but again, it's gentrification, and that's quite worrying as well, that as, people can't afford the flats in Manchester, flats are then getting bought up, and the boundaries are shifting, and people are now moving into areas in which moves families out, and rent. I mean, rent in Salford now is extortionate.
You know? And this is obviously destructive of and corrosive of community life. And I'm thinking the way in which the wealth of the City of London has moved eastwards into Spitalfields, yeah. and so those working class communities around Brick Lane in London are getting moved out. The incredible speed of new build in central Manchester then plays out in destroying communities around. So we end up with wealthy inner cities surrounded by a ring of upmarket commuter land and then low-paid workers travelling a long way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And like you say, you look at East London and that's, I think, Salford in some ways sort of reminds me of that, you know, what happened with the sort of gentrification, you know, in East London. It was that, you know, in some ways I think with Salford as well, there is an element that it attracted sort of artists like East London did at that point, that because they couldn't afford anywhere else, so they could have a, they could set up a studio. We've got, you know, we've got Islington Mill, a great little, you know, what's quite a big sort of art centre, and then there's the White Hotel, that's a great little club venue, and it's actually used to be a mechanics yard, so the bar is actually you have to, you know, you have to bend down. The bar is underground, you know, and it's very rough and ready. And those areas, I think, attract, because we've got these venues, they attract sort of people who, artists who couldn't afford, you know, to live in the City of Manchester. But then once those artists move in, people want a piece of that, don't they? So then it's sort of unfortunate. Then it creates demand for how, you know, and then it becomes, then the people who sat up, and that just, I mean, obviously the huge communities, you know, so the communities in East London, Bangladesh communities that you feel that have got, you know, pushed out. And
that kind of space for young musicians and young artists is absolutely crucial, because where's the creative?
Yeah.
If you don't give young musicians the chance to play and rehearse, you don't give artists the space to paint, well, what happens in the long run? We all lose.
But then there's town, there's a place in, there's a mill now in Lee. I mean, Lee's quite a way out of Manchester in a way, but they've, but what's brilliant, they've set up this project now, which has now got, it's got a cinema in it. I think it's something like £10, it might not even be £10 a week, it might be £10 a month, I need to get my facts right, but they're renting spaces out within this mill to young up-and-coming artists. And it's then about bringing those communities into those smaller towns, those towns, you know, because I think what happened, everyone felt in the north, you had to be in London to be creative. It was all, everyone had to move to London, which I did, you know, well, if you want to be an artist or in the creative field, London where's it's at. And then it becomes sort of, and then it became Manchester's where it's at. But to somebody, I grew up in Bolton, but, you know, it's 15 miles away, 20 miles away. But, you know, when you're young and you're skinned, it feels like 15 years away, you know what I mean? So it's about how do we bring, you know, the possibility and the exposure and availability to sort of artists who don't necessarily know Manchester's becoming too expensive for people to live, to travel into, you know? So it is exciting to see that, you know, sort of, you know, Lee was a small, very sort of working class mining town, has now taken this initiative. So a woman called Elizabeth Costello and her sort of, sort of colleagues have, in, you know, invested in.
But it means that as a whole, as a policy, we should be encouraging creativity, art, music everywhere.
Exactly.
The idea you've got to go to London to succeed really doesn't cut it to me.
No, and it's
I mean,
such
I didn't grow up in London.
View.
I grew up in the country. So to me, going to London was a big step. But I don't see it as a solution to everything. I see it's everywhere.
No, and I mean, I speak to so many young, especially young actors now, because they will come and speak to me about where, you know, we're based in the north. And I'd say it's changed over the last 10 years. People say, oh, do I have to go to London? Do you think I have to go to London? And now people are going, you know what, we're not going. We can't afford to go. There's no way, you know, and many artists now are coming out of London because they can't afford it, you know. Yeah. So it's about setting up the infrastructure in the community.
Has Media City made a difference?
I think it has. Initially, I must admit, and I was quite critical of Media City at the beginning, because it was like, where are the jobs for the local people? And what worried me at first, it was security, it was people working in the supermarkets. It's like, but this, where are you encouraging the young people to start off? You know, because it's all about education, isn't it? People say, you know, how do you get, when people are talking about people from different backgrounds, you know, sort of diversity, you go, well, look, if you're starting, you have to start young. You have to tell people that's something, young children, that that's something that is possible for them. It's not even going, well, we can't, the people are not applying, young people are not applying, people from this background, of course they're not applying, because they don't think it's a possibility. If you're not, it's that saying, is that you can't see, you can't be what you can't see.
Do you see this creativity in art and music and so on as something that feeds into trade unions? Because we're now in a time when we've got the rail industry in dispute, we've got the communications industry, both postal and electronic, in dispute through the CWU, and we've got the teachers in colleges and schools, civil servants and health workers. What I'm seeing at all of these events is an inclusivity I've never known before between people in different places. Is there a role for creative art and creative industry in this as well?
I think so. I think it's all, like you say, it's about us all coming together, isn't it? I mean, I think it's that, I mean, I always feel sometimes you get separated because you're in the arts. I know I get criticised, you know, and even when I first started out, you chose to do that, you know, that's the job that you chose to do. But I think we can support each other, and there's so many ways that, you know, it's not just about getting, you know, I don't know, putting on a, you know, awareness that the people in the arts can raise awareness. It's not about that, but it's just about, we are our workers at the end of the day, whatever. I mean, I know people say, well, you're in the arts, that's a middle-class endeavour, but actually that's, and I think that what drives me mad, because that pushes so many people away then. You know, we all have one life to lead, don't we? And we need to be encouraged that one thing you have to do is make a living. Another thing you want to do is be able to do something you really enjoy, if you can, if you're in that lucky minority that does something that you love to make that living. But yeah, I think it is about us. We're all up against it, in every sector.
Equity just got a new banner. Yes. I saw it at the Toll Puddle Martyrs March. Fantastic. Yeah. But inclusivity in the arts, yeah. A very strong anti-racist message there. Yeah. And also a big presence. And what was interesting was the interaction between people there who didn't see actors as something different and exotic. They saw them as part and parcel of employment. And a lot of people in theatre and film are quite exploited and not well paid, aren't they?
Yeah. I think this is the thing. There's a bit of a myth about, you know, the acting world. I've got my own. There's different levels, isn't there? And so I think people lump everyone together with what's going on, these sort of big stars, Hollywood stars. But there's a hell of a lot of inequality. There's a lot of problems with pay, a lot of problems. You know, if you look at most hours that actors work, there's a lot of actors working for next to nothing. You know, there was a big thing when I remember I left drama school, it was all like, you do a play and you got a travel card, that was it, that was your, but you're expected to do it because you're an actor and you really want to do it. It's a vocation, it's not a job, but people still have to eat. You know, so that's what happens when it becomes the disparities, that then people who can afford to do that because they have got a private income, or parents who can afford, you know, that's, it starts at such a, you know, that big early level that people straight away get pushed out.
I've got many young actors living in my constituency, and the problems they have is they work sporadically.
Yeah.
They do other jobs in bars and restaurants and sometimes teaching, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And then they might have a good year when they earn quite a bit. My view is that should be taxed over a much longer period to be fairer to them.
Yeah.
Take it over an average of 5 years or something.
And I don't think a lot of pay within theatre and television has risen, like everybody has, with the cost of living. There's a real problem. I think people think, especially if you do theatre, you must be getting paid a fortune. Regional theatre is, it's below the minimum wage when you work out how many hours you work, you rehearse and then you do the shows, and there's a lot of people really struggling. And I remember years ago, friends would go, oh, well, I'll do a couple of like episodes, you know, an episode of this, episode of that, and then the theatre work, and they could get through the year. That isn't happening anymore.
Outside, they think of a few famous names earning probably fairly good income.
Yeah.
They forget that there's thousands of others on minimum wage, or effectively less in some cases.
Yeah, and people are self-employed, I think, as well. I think people, you know, you love somebody like, I had a friend who was in a TV series. She was in one series of something. She's hardly worked since, but because she's recognised from that TV series, people think she's like, that was 1 year I got a decent wage. I scrape by all the time. But because she's been in the public eye, people will say, think you've, you know, I think there must be some fun there.
So She's a, wicked EastEnders. They think she's mega rich.
I mean, don't get me wrong, there's some obscenely rich, you know, and there's a lot of money bandying about now with the new streaming services. But again, it's the disparity of you will pay a big star to be in it, a lot of money, and then it's how it trickles, the effect trickles down. You know, it doesn't, it's quite unfair in that.
Well, trickle-down economics hasn't worked in the wider society, so there's no reason to suppose it'll work in arts either.
Yeah, it needs a good overhaul. It needs a really good overhaul.
So we're in for a summer of determination, as I put it, and probably a winter of discontent, but this time, let's get equity on side, yeah?
Yeah.
They need to be there. And also, I'm very interested in the barristers' strike.
Yeah, yeah.
I never thought the day would come when I get lobbied in Parliament by a delegation of barristers from my constituency.
Yeah.
The most articulate lobby I've ever met in my life.
I bet.
But they weren't short. But they actually got a very fair case.
Yeah,
young lawyers, young actors.
Exactly, and it's a similar thing. Young, you know, training to go to the bar now. It becomes who can afford that? Who can?
Yeah.
It's a society made only for those who have. They don't want. It feels like anybody. If you're not in the club, you've no chance.
If we don't invest in education, we don't invest in decent paying conditions, then it's going to be the children of the rich and the public schools that will be the actors, the famous sports people, etc.
Yeah.
Today we were commemorating Peterloo.
Yes.
Dramatic, vile, and murderous of people. And Shelley's poem says it all very well. Did you grow up understanding anything about Peterloo, or did it come to you later on?
You know, I had a grandfather, step-grandfather James Taylor, who gave me a very sort of potted political left. Very left-leaning political history of Manchester. So I knew a little bit about Peterloo.
Mm-hmm.
But, I was never taught it in school. And it was only when I got asked to do, it was Manchester International Festival, and they asked me if I would perform The Mask of Anarchy that year that I became much more aware of Peterloo. And I think it's been celebrated in Manchester on a very low key, but it's amazing to see over the years, in the last sort of 10 years, that the citizens of Manchester have really really embraced it. And because it's, you know, people have started to see the parallels, you know, they've started to, you know, they're reflecting back at them. I mean, you know, they're more heightened now than ever, and I think people have really got on board. I mean, when you think, I used to sort of read the names on a street corner to about 80 people, and then now you've got hundreds of people turning up to...
Well, today was big, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was huge.
A lot of people there.
It was brilliant. I mean, of course, we had amazing speakers, so people came down to, you know, it was a full event, but to see it grow, you know, and just it's something now that Manchester's, I suppose, you know, it's proud that we should never forget it. And obviously, you know, knowing we're in that, you know, in that situation again.
But that period after the Battle of Waterloo, we're all taught about the genius of Wellington and the field at Waterloo, but what we're not taught about is the tens of thousands of soldiers that came home to poverty, that came home to hunger, that came home to homelessness, and their anger. And so it wasn't a coincidence that St Peter's Fields, Peterloo, it wasn't a coincidence that Cinderloo in Shropshire, which I talked about today, given the same name, it was cinders being thrown at soldiers, why it's called Cinderloo. It was that whole opposition to the ruling class at that time, which was brutally repressed.
Yeah.
We've got to remember that and understand from that.
Well, exactly. And it is that whole thing. If we don't learn from our past, are we ever going to change the future, move forward?
History can be so empowering, can't it? But the way we're taught it is so weakening.
Well, it's like, you know, when you talk about the English Civil War, I didn't learn at school about the levellers and the diggers and, you know, the ranters and this whole, you know, although it was, you know, history at school was very basic. You know, it was kings and queens and, you know, nothing about working class history. I remember sort of learning a little bit about agriculture and that was it. And
I was told there was an interregnum between two kings.
There was
an interregnum.
I don't even know what that means.
No, I didn't either. Apparently it was the gap between Charles I and Charles II.
Right.
That was when Cromwell was about.
So
we weren't told a word about the levellers or the diggers or the debate within the Republican parliamentary movement. We weren't taught anything about that. It's absolutely central. And even law in this country is central to the separation of the parliament and the king.
But they don't want us to know.
No.
Because they know the power. That's what you want to say. You want to encourage people to keep digging and excavating the past because you go, the power of it. Why do they bury it? Because it's so powerful. They know how potent it is if we get hold of that.
That's why we've got to be at the Diggers Festival in Wigan, haven't
we? Is it 11th of September?
It is indeed. Coming very soon.
Yeah.
I'm going to be there. You're going to be there.
But I'm going to be away
filming.
Oh,
you're going to be away then.
I'm going to be away filming, so I won't be able to make it down. But yeah. I mean, it's great again. Who'd have thought in Wigan, you know, in the centre of Wigan, that there was the Diggers Festival again has grown and grown. There's a need for it. People are looking for a way to express themselves.
See, I think we're moving into a time where people are searching for something.
Yeah.
And they're not searching for regulation of energy companies. They're searching for control of our resources, control. Public control of what we can achieve. So I just think it's incredible what's happening, and I'm very pleased to be part of it. I know some people would say we're in a very depressing time. I don't think we are. I think we're in a time of the most amazing optimism of people who are saying they've had enough.
Because I think we look in, don't we? We look at our political parties and you know, our leadership and going, but there's more to it than that.
It's not just about political parties and positions. It's about the mood people have. Are they going to put up with this inequality and injustice in our society? Or
but it's just
do something about it?
Yeah, but people need somewhere to go, okay, don't we? We need a little bit of a guiding hand to go, well, what can we do? How do we get everyone together and go, this is what we can do?
Now, you've done a lot for Miscarriage of Justice campaign, and there's no greater miscarriage of justice than Hillsborough.
Yeah.
Hillsborough, working class community, denigrated for something they didn't do.
Yeah.
And you played a big part in the film on that. What was that like?
So I played Anne Williams, who was the mother of Kevin Williams, who was 15 when he went off to Hillsborough that morning to watch the football match and never came home. And he was one of the 97 that died. He died on the day, was crushed. And Anne, she knew, you know, even before a lot of the information came out, that, you know, once the papers and the press and the establishment pointed the finger at the fans, and she knew just in her heart that that wasn't, you know, that wasn't her son. Those weren't the people at that football match. So she decided to go on a sort of quest for justice, really, and that's what she did. Her and many other families, but the drama I did focused on. And we had the brilliant Jimmy McGovern's Hillsborough many years ago and that. So this sort of took on, and it never, and Anne's story didn't sort of appear in Hillsborough. So this drama was a charting her story from Kevin's murder, really.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Kevin's murder up to her finding, you know, some sort of justice, but not, you know, she got a little bit what she was finding for, and then unfortunately she died. But it was a real honour to be part of that. And yeah, it was heartbreaking. And you think you know a story till you start really researching it. And just the, you know, miscarriage of justice was appalling, and the cover-ups were appalling, and the way people were treated and the families were treated. It was brutal and it was unacceptable.
When you play a part like that, you're putting yourself into somebody else's shoes, aren't you?
Yes, yes.
Is that tough?
I mean, it's never as tough as being the person, is it? You know, you do. I feel blessed every night. At least I can go home and I can, you know, turn off. But you do become, it's not that I particularly stay in character, but you become very obsessed with the subject matter. You know, it's a time when you have to go, you have to let it go now. You finish the job. But you do, and of course, you feel the fury just as you as a human being, the rage and at the injustice, you know, which is, you know, you have to sort of take that. Well, you know, you can put that into the character. You can. But it's, yeah, and it's this whole lineage, isn't it? We're talking about Peterloo, but Peterloo to Hillsborough to, you know, Grenfell to what happened at Manchester Arena. There's all these, that happening, and it's ordinary working people. And to be able to be part of those stories.
Those series, things like Hillsborough and that, actually empower people, I think, because they begin to see history as something real.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas if you just give a student a history book, they might read it and they might understand some, but if you give them something tangible and real. Yeah. Maybe they'll see it differently.
And it's keeping reminding people. So many people came up to me and said, oh, right, that's what happened. And then people who thought they knew it, but as well just reminding people of the actual onslaught of the press, the lies spread by The Sun and many other publications, you know, and the demonising of those Liverpoolian, you know, fans, what they accused them of doing to, you know, people were laid dying and it, you know, people were saved because of the fans, because the fans, you know, quick thinking when there were ambulances stuck outside, not allowed onto the pitch, and there's people dying. And, you know, so the appalling nature, as we know, of our British press and what they did to, you know, distort the truth.
But the same thing happened at Stade de France, didn't it?
And it still feels intrinsic, doesn't it? There's been so many things recently, haven't there, that people have, oh, I slipped up when I, Hillsborough and hooliganism, you know, people that have been interviewed, and it's become, even though people go, oh, I didn't mean it like that, but it's become so, the press have had, the poison has seeped in so much to people's psyche that is, so the things like Anne, you just hope people can just explode that for people and go, this is the truth. This is what happened. These are the lies. These are the people. These are ordinary people. This is an ordinary young boy. He was still a boy, 15, went off to watch a football match, full of hope on a beautiful summer's day in April and never came home. And that's not acceptable. And then to blame him and the other victims, and not just the people who died, but, you know, people's lives have been, the trauma of the Hillsborough survivors. You know, people, I still bump into people who say, you know, I met a guy the other day and he said to me, I was there, my family don't know, I was there. And he started to cry and he said, I'm dealing with this every day. It doesn't go away, but I don't, you know, and you just think, wow, it's
never
it's
leaves
huge.
Them.
No, and it doesn't. And it ripples on. It goes down through generations of trauma.
The media have got a big role in this. I mean,
exactly.
Look at the way The Sun have reported Liverpool over the years.
Yeah.
And quite rightly, people on Merseyside don't have The Sun. But I'm thinking, I was very involved in the Guildford 4 and Birmingham 6 campaigns. And when the campaigns began, the abuse was unbelievable. They said, well, everybody knows these guys are murderers. I said, do they? No. And it was like, The Sun has said, therefore.
It's absolutely disgusting.
It's beyond irresponsible.
It should be illegal. It's lies. It's distorting the truth. And then we get, why are we in the situation? I do hold our prayers very responsible for the situation we're in now. And people, and it's not, I don't believe it's people's job. People say, well, you shouldn't read it. And I said, well, it's not people's jobs to, a lot of people haven't got the time or energy to decipher what the truth is. They shouldn't have to. It should be there. It shouldn't be.
But miscarriage of justice campaigns, we've, through the Peace and Justice Project, we've set up a quite big working group of miscarriage of justice campaigns. Because if you think about it, a miscarriage of justice isn't something that you can plan for or know about in advance. We're dealing with this case of this poor little boy, Zane, who was killed by poisoning from an illegal dump outside his house. The house was flooded, and he was poisoned with hydrogen cyanide coming from this dump. His family had no notion this thing was there. His dad was paralysed from the waist downwards for the rest of his life, and it's obviously beyond traumatic. Their family in no way could have prepared for any of that. And so what I find there is, likewise with Jengba, not guilty by association, is that people get either frightened, traumatised and very isolated and don't know where to turn. If you're sort of quite political and well-connected, you kind of work out, well, I can get so-and-so to help and we can start a campaign. And we've got some lawyers on side. Many don't have that option.
Exactly.
So what we're trying to do is bring all the groups together, not in any way to tell people what to do, but to give them the support and resources to empower them.
Yes.
It's empowerment of people. Exactly. And that's the way of challenging this.
Brilliant. Because you do, it's all the red tape. It's a minefield. And of course, they throw that at you. You think, where do I start? How do you fight against the establishment? And it's knowing that
there's people
is support, there, though, can give you, can hold your hand through, can guide you, can, yeah.
I think we're moving into a time, I'm actually very hopeful and very optimistic. I know everybody says I shouldn't be, but I am, and you are.
Well, why,
because there's only one way to deal with this cost of living crisis, the only one way to deal with injustice, the only one way to deal with environmental crisis, and that's uniting together to fight back.
Yeah, and you see,
for us, for our movement and our class.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've got, yeah, that's it. Solidarity, strength, and we know, don't we? And it's, I feel that it, yeah, I do feel it is hopeful. It is hopeful.
And it's about exciting young people.
Yeah. But the new generation coming in, there's no flies on them. They are so smart. They are, you know, I'm always impressed now by, especially people, you know, the contact I've come with young people in my profession who are so on it.
Yeah.
They know everything, you know, they've dissected everything. We can't do that. That's not right. This is not right. And it's brilliant because they've, you know, I came from a generation who just got a job and went, thank you very much for the job. Thank you. Oh, I've got an acting job. How exciting. And now they go, no, this isn't right. This isn't right. This isn't right. And I'm like, it's so exciting to see they're taking, you know, they're taking on that fight.
And young people, gig economy, 0 hours jobs, working all the hours they can get work for, delivering food, delivering Uber Eats, et cetera, et cetera. They need to be in a union. They need to be strong. And they are getting in unions. They are getting strong.
But it's saying to people, isn't it? Understanding it isn't. It's like, you know, old comrades used to say to me, you have to take pleasure in the struggle, Maxine, you know, because there's so many times when I was younger and I got, oh, what's the point? You know, you'd get. And I miss when I got into politics, it was sort of the late 80s, early 90s, and lots of people were dropping out. It was, the thing was, you went off grid.
You know what I mean? A bit odd, did they?
Yeah, a bit.
But that time after the miners' strike, mid to late 80s, was quite difficult.
Yeah, of course. But it's, it is exciting, but it's just holding on in there, isn't it? It's never easy.
That's right.
But we wouldn't want easy.
I remember Tony Benn saying, there's never a final victory, there's never a final defeat. You have to fight the same old battles day after day, time after time.
Yeah.
And that way you convince the next generation.
Yeah.
He was right.
It's their time now, so we have to adapt to what as well, you know.
And it's a different form of communications. It's social media, it's music, it's theatre, it's art. It's not the tradition of small meetings, rallies and so on. It's, things have changed a lot, and we've got to understand communication is about being heard, being seen and being there, being active. Yeah. So I guess we're going to see each other on the picket lines. Lots of picket lines.
Yeah.
So from the Peace and Justice Project, with absolutely no expense spared, can I offer you a reward for coming to do an interview?
Yes.
You're very brave.
Jeremy, it's legal.
I've got here a jar of fig jam made just under a year ago from my allotment. Peace and Justice label on the top, signed. Figs from the allotment,
thank you, our love to you, and
thank you for all you do.
Thank you
for the inspiration you are to so many people.
Well, thank you for everything you do and being a constant inspiration. Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you for this jam.
I'm just doing my job.
Brilliant.
Maxine, thank you so much.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much. Thanks, Jeremy.